Oak session number 12149, reel 9.
Captain Sutton, reel 9.
The 6-inch guns were relocated slightly so that they controlled the bridge over the Tabernacious River, and at about the same time Commander Beale was asked by Andrew to resite the airfield camp. The airfield camp had been on the banks of the Tabernacious. This was outside the defense zone that Andrews was developing, and so we were asked to move inside the defended zone, which Beale did, and the airfield camp was placed on the slopes of Hill 107 above the runways on the slopes of Hill 107 above the runway, brought in. At the same time as the moving in there, and with the MMBDO coming in, we had Australian anti-aircraft gunners arrive. These were Beaufort's gunners, and the Royal Marines also had Beaufort's guns. I can't remember how many they had, but quite a lot of Beaufort's guns we had around the place. I think there must have been about 10 Royal Australian artillery and about 10 Royal Marine ones. But we were coming in quite a heavily defended area. We, on the other hand, on the airfield, had no arms. 805 Squadron had been established there for some time. It had .303 British rifles. All the refugees from Greece and so on arrived with nothing, so that we had all the ground crews from the Air Force in 30 and 33 Squadron, and the officers had no arms. The officers were mostly, when they were armed, they got armed by naval pistols. I had a naval pistol, Webley 4.5. We had no small arms, and we made up this deficiency by stripping out the guns of any aircraft which crashed, whether it was a rear gun or front guns. They were given improvised mountings, and it meant, of course, that if they were used, that they would burn out fairly quickly because they were mostly air-cooled guns, but that they could be used until they did burn out. As we developed the defences, we got more and more intelligence that was given to us, and it was obvious that the Germans were intending an airborne and a seaborne invasion of Crete. We were told that this was very largely learnt because of lax German wireless discipline. But in actual fact, we know now that we had broken our main code, cipher machine, and that we were getting pretty full reports of what they were going to do. The sort of level that I was, that this sort of knowledge wasn't known to me until after the war. But that is the situation. The detailed German plans were known to our high command. We found after a fairly short time that we had to defend the airfield on the aircraft on the airfield by grouping guns in their defense and also by making aircraft pens. The pens, we had them at the various dispersals. We then found that they could be bombed or taken out too easily unless they were also defended by guns. And so we finished up by making the pens at the base of the hill with the open end of the pen looking out towards the sea, so that if an aircraft attacked it, it attacked into the pen and then had to fly up belly up over the hill, where it was then vulnerable to all the anti-aircraft guns disposed on the hill. Now this worked. We brought down two Messerschmitts, absolutely riddled with fire, with bullets, but the enemy superiority was so intense that we lost fighters, one after the other, mostly on the ground, one or two in the air. As things became more and more desperate, we were getting from about, I suppose, from about the 14th or 15th of May onwards, we were getting great big swarms of fighters coming in, 24 at a time, attacking the airfield. We sent away the fighter Blenheims. They were no good against the Messerschmitt 109s, and so they were flown away to Egypt. That left us really with only the Hurricanes. By that time, all the naval aircraft had been knocked out, and the 33 Squadron, Hurricane pilots, and 805 Squadron fighter pilots made a pool, and they flew any serviceable Hurricane that was available. The naval and RAF fighters all mixing in together in one squadron, in effect. About the 15th, I suppose, of May, Luff had got his Swordfish serviceable, and we were anxious to get it and the Greek aircraft away before they were knocked out on the ground by the Germans. And he took off, in actual fact, on the morning of a day when the first very large German attack developed. And this was a most hairy experience. One saw this black cloud of fighters coming in from the sea to attack us, and at the same time, Luff and his four Greek Avros had taken off and were forming up just over the sea off Malmö. Luckily, their camouflage was sufficiently good against the sea. The green and khaki camouflage of the and green and grey camouflage, green and khaki of the Greeks, and the green and khaki and grey of the naval aircraft were sufficiently good that they weren't seen by the Messerschmitts, who passed over them. And Luff flew away, and he went down along the coast to Heraklion, where he refueled, and then took them away to Greece, Egypt. That was that. On the attacks were so intense that to get any work done, there was no good taking shelter at an air raid warning, because there was, during daylight and most of the night as well, an air raid warning. There were always enemy aircraft in the area. By day there were swarms, and by night there were solitary bombers droning away and dropping bombs on us just to keep us happy. And so at every airfield working party we had a lookout, and the lookouts were not watching round for enemy aircraft attacking. They were watching a position that we established on top of the hill, 107, one of the knolls, 107, And there were a group of RAF men with binoculars and a church bell and a large red flag. And the radar station gave a warning of aircraft coming in. And when the enemy aircraft was seen to be turning into the airfield to make an attack, then the group of observers on top of the hill who were watching then gave the warning. And they rang the bell and waved the flag, and that meant to say that you dive for cover. There was no question about waiting to see what happened. You dive for cover because you knew you had about 15 seconds at the most before the attack was going to develop. And this worked. We managed to keep the aircraft reasonably serviceable. But what it didn't do, of course, was to protect the Greek workmen. The Greek became... They were being shot up. They were getting casualties on the airfield. And they weren't at all happy, workmen, to work under these conditions. And on one occasion, I found the Works and Bricks officer, Deakin, with his pistol out, threatening a group of Greek workmen, you know, I'm going to shoot them. And so I persuaded him to put his pistol away, and I went to Commander Beale, and he said, well, you'll have to deal with the Greek workmen in future. And so Deakin told me what he wanted doing in the way of work, and I then instructed the Greeks what to do, and got on quite well with them. You can see that people's nerves were starting to go very badly. We were being bombed at night. Now, I had been the naval liaison officer in the desert for a short period before going to Athens, and I knew about being bombed at night and how to leave. I dug myself a hole in my tent, a slit trench, in effect, about 9 inches a foot deep. And in that, I set my camp bed. It meant that if I was bombed, then with luck, the bomb blast would go over me. It wasn't raining at that period, but you put drainage ditches either side so that if it did, as there was a large shower, it wouldn't affect you. In fact, the whole of the area was starting to dry up quite considerably. The Tavernitis River was almost dry. There was a little trickle of water down it now, at this stage, and that was all, whereas when I first arrived at the end of April, there had been quite a flow of water. About the 17th, I should think, probably, we got a supply of rifles. These were American 300 First World War rifles, and each of us on the airfield were issued with a rifle and a bandolier of 20 rounds of ammunition in a cloth bandolier, four clips of ammunition. We found that quite a number of the RAF people had never been taught to shoot. It's a strange situation. In fact, it is. I mean, it's one of the characteristics of the Air Force, you see, that they are a technical service with very gallant airmen who go out and do combat. Then they come back to generally to a secure base. It's the way things go. And so the ground crews had not been taught to fight. Some had, but not a lot of them. We then had the problem of teaching men to shoot. These rifles were intended, of course, for the self-protection of the air crew. And various people like flight sergeants, corporals, myself, we took on instruction, teaching men to shoot. We used the reflector sight. I don't know what it's called, it's sort of prism. You look in sideways along it and you can see where the man's aiming. and you can tell him how to how to adjust his aim. And once we'd got them aiming synthetically, we then let them fire three rounds at a target. So those men had 17 rounds left, the rest of us had 20 rounds to meet an invasion. About the same time as the rifles arrived, General Freiburg came and gave us a briefing. I was allowed to attend, although it was mostly the company commanders and so on, the New Zealanders, but Beale took me in. And this was a most impressive thing. Here was his VC general talking about the battle that was going to happen and saying that what he was mostly worried about was the seaborne invasion which was coming, that we, the vital thing to do was that we had to hold Hill 107. That we may have to stand a siege of 3 days or more, but we would be relieved. We were to hold that position and dominate the airfield. And no account to give it up. And then I was present at a meeting between George Beale and the squadron commanders. I think Black was there, Howell and George Beale, discussing the implementation of the general's orders, and Andrews. And Andrews said that he wanted to, he wanted the airfield as a killing ground. There was no account where the airmen to stay down on the airfield, they would get clear in the event of invasion. It was after this that we did a practice evacuation of the airfield. Under the instruction of New Zealand sergeants and Royal Marine sergeants, we did an emergency evacuation of the airfield, falling back on the New Zealand positions on the hill. We were told to group ourselves into groups of 6 to 10 people, each group giving covering fire to another group and leapfrogging up the hill until we reached the New Zealand positions. We were not to stay on the airfield and get out of it. This evacuation, the practice one, went quite well. We did what we were told. We now had rifles, individual rifles. And the then I think that the next thing that happened was that about the 18th of May, the rest of the naval fighter pilots were sent down by flying boat from Suda Bay down to Alexandria to bring back reinforcement aircraft. And the last of the Hurricanes was knocked out by medium-level bombing by the Germans. They'd found it was too expensive in aircraft to attack the last of these pens which were where the aircraft was being protected. And as I say, we knocked out two of the Messerschmitts attacking. And so they came over and they took it out by medium-level bombing, crossing, until they eventually knocked it out. That was the last of our fighter offences. We knew at that stage that we were in for it. We knew that whilst we still had fighters left, that the Germans would be very wary of sending over a transport fleet of aircraft, because once you get into that, you can cause incredible damage. But that when the last of the fighters had gone, we knew we were really in for trouble. I had, shortly after taking over as assistant to Beale, I had taken on going round the airfield at examining positions and also seeing that sentries were stood to and so on at night defence positions. And I had come across a man whom I saw in the dusk, silhouetted against the light of the open window of the operations hut on the hillside. I knew, of course, the operations hut, and I'd been working there. There was somebody apparently outside the hut, looking in. I went up behind him very quietly and put my pistol and saw his back, heads up. Now, this man was a Greek soldier. I noticed him about a week before when he and a boatload of Greek refugee soldiers from the mainland had arrived. They'd wandered up to the camp, been rounded up, handed over to the Greek military authorities. This chap wasn't like the rest. He was much more alert and was looking round. The rest were dejected and tired and dispirited. He wasn't. He was an alert, bright-eyed little man.
Was he in uniform when you captured him?
That I can't remember. A couple of days later, I've been going round at dusk, or towards dusk, and I had found this chap helping an Australian Bofors gun crew down on the beach to sandbag their position. And I told the sergeant in charge to see this chap out of the defended area straight away, and that he was not to be employed on the airfield. He said, oh, for Christ's sake, he's only helping us. Now, I'd had words already with the sergeant because he had pinched engine covers from the fighter aircraft to provide a bivouac for his gun crew. And I had explained to him, and rather sort of prissy young naval officer, that if you took the engine covers, then the aircraft got dirt in them and they couldn't fly, and that meant to say that we lost our fighter cover. For God's sake, don't do that. And so he said, all right, and gave us back the engine covers. So I knew the flight, I knew the sergeant, and he got rid of this chap. Now, this was this man that I found looking in the operations room. So I drove away, handed him over to the New Zealanders, and he was taken in to Kania, where he was interrogated, I was told later, interrogated by the Greeks. He wouldn't say anything at all, and he was shot by the Greeks.
What was his demeanour when you captured him?
I don't know. I was very wary that he would turn on me, of course. I mean, I wasn't watching him, his face. I couldn't see. I mean, I knew the chap. I knew him. I'd seen him twice. And so he was one of the chaps I recognized on the place. I think, in actual fact, he was in workman's clothes at that stage. I don't think he was in uniform. He may have been in the remains of a Greek army uniform. I don't know.
What had been the demeanour of that other chap, the saboteur, when he'd been caught?
I think that he was very frightened, that one. This one was different. This one, I think that... lucky for me, I was able to hand him over fairly quickly, because we had, at that stage, quite a good defensive organisation running. Anyhow, the spy was taken away, and whatever he was, and he was shot. Now, from about the 18th, that was, I think, was the day after we received our rifles, 17th or 18th, we stood to every morning. It was a point of standing to until we had our rifles, I think. So we stood to every morning in defensive positions from first light before dawn until the sun was up. And then this was standing by awaiting invasion. Then we dispersed to breakfast, toilet, shave, wash, all the rest of it. This was the routine on the 18th, 19th, and the 20th of May. On the 20th, we dispersed to breakfast, etc., when there was an air raid warning. Now, this air raid warning was an intense air raid warning. Whereas in the past, the church bell had been rung for to call attention, this one, the bell went on ringing and 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 ringing, and the flag was waving. And in actual fact, we took shelter. There was the colonel, Beale, myself, I can't remember who else, all in the trench, fairly close to the officer's mess, took shelter. And then the most intensive air attack took place. This was absolutely earth-shattering. I think it's probably the nearest thing to a sort of First World War trench barrage, you know, in preparing for advance on the Western Front. The whole place shuddered and juddered, and the place reeked of explosives, and every time we looked up, there was a tree in the air sort of whistling along, branches flying, trees flying, masses of stone and dirt, dust all over the place. And it went on for quite a time. It's difficult to tell when you're under these sort of conditions, but it was a very intensive attack. And then it stopped. And we poked our heads out of the trench to see what was happening. And as we looked, we saw a great column of aircraft right out to sea to the horizon, black column of aircraft. And as we looked there, the leading aircraft started dropping parachutes. There was some terrific activity, of course, on our part. I had my pistol, my Webley 4.5, but my rifle was in my tent. So I rushed to my tent, got my rifle and my bandolier, and by the time I had got that, everybody else had disappeared. Andrew presumably got up to his command position, and Beale, well, his action station, in actual fact, was headquarters, the camp headquarters, a stone hut, where you could control things from there to a certain extent. And so I found nobody there when I got my rifle. I was on the hillside by myself.